Welcome to the Nanda Cast, brought to you by Nanda International. We explore evidence-based nursing diagnoses, giving clinical nurses, educators, and students the tools to deliver safe, effective, and patient-centered care. Let's get started.
Welcome to the Nanda Cast. I'm your host, Dr. Heather Herdman, Chief Executive Officer of Nanda International. Today, I am honored to welcome Dr. Mary Ann Lavin, one of our founders of Nanda International. She holds a diploma from St. John's Hospital School of Nursing, her BSN and MSN degrees, and her Advanced Nurse Practitioner Certificate from the St. Louis University School of Nursing, and a master's and doctorate from Harvard School of Public Health. Her career has included a plethora of things, and we could spend the entire day going through them. But I'll just suffice to say, 3 years of public health nursing in La Paz, Bolivia. She was a clinical nurse specialist in coronary care, director of the cardiovascular nursing program at St. Louis University, and an associate professor in both undergraduate and graduate programs at St. Louis University. As you may know, along with Dr. Christine Gebbe, Mary Ann co-coordinated the 1973 First National Conference on the Classification of Nursing Diagnoses, which evolved to become the North American Nursing Diagnosis Association, and then in 2002 became Nanda International. She has served as Nanda I's president. She is a charter Nanda I fellow, as well as a fellow in the American Academy of Nursing. In 2024, she was recognized as a pioneer in nursing informatics by the Nursing Informatics Interest Group of the American Medical Informatics Association, and she was named a living legend by Nanda International in 2023. It is just a great honor to have you here, Mary Ann, and we could spend much more time detailing your career, and we will get to some of it as we move along today. But I kind of like to start our conversation by asking you to take a step back in time to the 1970s when you and Chris Gebbe were graduate students. Can you tell us why you began to look at what eventually became nursing terminology or what we now know as nursing diagnosis? Like, whatever possessed you to go down that route?
Well, that was the time when I was directing the cardiovascular nursing program, and Chris was our mental health consultant. And what started it was that Joan Carter, who later was associate dean at the school, was at the time director of the hospital department of nursing. And she called up one afternoon and said, Mary Ann, how are we going to get nursing diagnoses in the computer? How are we going to get nursing data in the computer? And I said, well, how do physicians plan on doing it? And remember, this is 1973. And she said, well, by diagnosis. And I said, well, then we'll do it by nursing diagnoses. And she said, Mary Ann, they have a classification. It's called the ICD. We don't have a classification. And I said, well, we'll create one. And I said, I'll get back to you. So I hung up, went across the hall to Chris, and I said, Chris, I just promised Joan Carter that we would create a nursing classification. How are we going to do it? And she said, we'll call a conference. And I said, okay. And I said, we'll have it here at SLU. And she said, yes. And I said, how many? And she said, well, let's invite 100. And I said, okay. And she said, but it has to be competitive. And I said, how? And she said, well, ask them to submit an essay. And I said, on nursing diagnoses. And she said, yes. So that's how it all started. Later that night, about 2 hours later, we were both down in the basement in another office. And Chris said, I just had another idea. And I said, what? And she said, we'll call it the national. We had already decided it was going to be the first conference on nursing diagnoses. Chris said, it'll be the first national conference. And I said, Chris, we don't have any authority to call a national conference. And she said, but we're inviting people from across the United States, right? And I said, yes. She said, then it's national.
Hey, if you don't name it, it doesn't happen, right?
Right. So that's how it all started. Then we went to the dean, and she was all in favor of it, Sister Mary Teresa Noth. And then she went to the authorities at the university, and the medical school people said no. So then we said, well, we'll still have it. We'll just have it at this old hotel downtown. And Sister Teresa arranged for us to move all the office equipment down there because this old hotel did not have a business office. Yeah. So we created a business office and had the conference in 1973.
You know, this strikes me as a wonderful opportunity for nursing students to think about when you think things are impossible, how you just kept going. Well, we can't do it this way. We're going to do it this way. Well, you can't do it this way. You're going to do it this way. And honestly, Marianne, when I think we look at your life, that's kind of the story of your life is you tend not to see barriers. You just say, well, we're just going to go around that barrier and move to the next step. So when you were trying to look at these diagnoses, what was the purpose? Why did you need them? Or why did your dean feel that you needed them?
Well, the director of nursing at the hospital thought we needed them in order to enter data into the computer.
Okay. And okay, what was the purpose of what though? What was the purpose of having the data in the computer?
So that we would be able to document nursing practice.
Okay.
In a manner analogous to the way in which physicians document medical practice. That's not saying that we used a medical model. You know, just because we diagnose doesn't mean that we use a medical model. Plumbers diagnose. You know, architects diagnose. People in climate science diagnose. Everybody diagnoses. To diagnose is just a problem-solving method.
Exactly. I love that you say that because I hear people still to this day say, you know, nurses don't need to diagnose, as if it's a bad thing for a nurse to do that. And I think, well, when you listen to television, the car mechanics say, we will diagnose your car's problems. You know, it is the end point of a judgment. And of course, nurses use judgment, whether you want to call it a nursing diagnosis or not. They are determining what's going on with their patients. So,
right.
Yeah. So if you fast forward to today, so 50 some years later, mm-hmm. and you look at nursing classification, has the purpose for those classifications changed at all in your mind, or has it evolved in any way?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's becoming even more exciting today than what it was then, because nurses are beginning to correlate nursing diagnoses and their respective interventions with specific outcomes, not just an outcome based on a 5-scale Likert, on a 5-point Likert scale, but with nursing outcomes that are related to laboratory outcomes, like bioinflammatory markers. And I think this is very exciting because as we, for instance, the nurses at Johns Hopkins were investigating coping self-efficacy and found that bioinflammatory biomarkers and coping self-efficacy are indirectly related. As coping self-efficacy goes up, inflammatory biomarkers go down.
It makes perfect sense.
Right.
Makes perfect sense.
Right.
So, you know, when I was a student, I didn't really have instructors who understood the point of nursing diagnosis. I was kind of in that early group of people who were learning about diagnoses. And we were often automatically linking nursing diagnosis to medical diagnoses, honestly, from care planning books, which is, of course, completely wrong. and yet we still see it being taught this way to this day in some locations. And maybe more concerning, we see electronic health record companies that are providing standardized care plans that have been developed in this way. So standardization has been implemented in many instances as a recipe rather than an application of clinical reasoning or using diagnosis to name those judgments based on assessment and clinical reasoning. So what do you say to nurse educators about how they might integrate nursing diagnosis or even clinical reasoning as a whole across the nursing curriculum, as opposed to in this one introductory class, as many of us get it, and then we forget about it along the way?
Okay. Well, if we take coping self-efficacy, we could ask nursing students to identify a moment in their own lives in which coping self-efficacy was high, and another moment in which coping self-efficacy was low, and to identify the signs and symptoms of each, and whether or not low coping self-efficacy was associated with other signs and symptoms like joint pain or fatigue or depression, or what, have them identify within their own selves, within their own family, within their own acquaintances, the frequency or the prevalence of nursing diagnoses in their own life. I think that's a good beginning way to start, and then to transfer it to the bedside when they go into clinical practice, to find out, to interview the patient in such a way that the patient begins talking about those episodes. And surprisingly, they will be associated with medical diagnoses, but medical diagnoses, I think, will be subservient to the nursing diagnoses and not vice versa.
Ah, I love that. You know, I love that you said start with yourself or start with the people around you, because I think one of the things that I notice when I talk to students and even to faculty who are new at teaching diagnosis is we don't stop to think about what's the normal. What does coping self-efficacy look like when it's working? how would we know that, oh, this person has really good self-efficacy? And instead, we tend to start with, well, what's the problem? And I always say to students, how would you know what, you know, an effective breathing pattern looks like if you can't tell me what an effective breathing pattern is? So starting with that normal makes so much sense to me. And then kind of taking those concepts that we can all relate to, you know, self-efficacy, anxiety, pain, and thinking about how does it manifest in ourselves before we move on to the patient. I think that's a really good tip for faculty.
Right.
Yeah. So you talked about medical diagnosis. How do we help colleagues, and especially students, I think, to think about diagnosis in nursing the way that our colleagues in medicine think of diagnosis in their field? Not as documentation so much, but as representing the judgments about those things that are primary areas of concern for patients that we as nurses can treat, as well as how it gives, you know, maybe a term that others can understand across setting and country. I think that we have a real strong sense that we all have to know the medical diagnosis, but not so much a strong sense that we need to know the nursing diagnosis. So what would you say to students about why you think that's important?
I think nursing diagnoses relate directly to manifestations of human behavior in one aspect or another.
You know, you have a background in public health. And just as a quick commentary for those who may not know, public health is different than what many people think of as community health nursing in some countries. in that public health nursing focuses, and correct me if I'm wrong here, on broader population health issues and policy development, whereas community health nursing tends to focus more on direct care and promotion of health within specific communities or people. And as we're facing more and more global challenges from climate change, food insecurity, violent conflicts, I mean, unfortunately, we can go on and on. I'm wondering how you see nursing diagnosis that could be seen as influencing these key issues.
Well, Larry Green from Johns Hopkins, Dr. Larry Green, developed the idea of public health diagnoses, epidemiologic diagnoses, after we had a conversation once upon a time. And so I think nursing can draw from, I think it's bi-directional. I think we need to draw from public health the data skills needed to examine etiologies of our nursing diagnoses in a manner analogous to the way in which public health examines etiologies in epidemiology. And I think epidemiology needs to develop a classification, which is still lacking, even though they use a diagnostic framework more frequently now, and they use diagnostic terminology more frequently. I still don't think they have a classification of public health diagnoses. So I think that's a first step, so that things like within the hunger domain could be more specifically identified and used more fluidly within the language of public health professionals. So it's all a matter of terminology, like the little 12-year-old. It's all terminology. So the more we get accustomed to using a diagnostic reasoning process and arriving at judgments within our profession, and the more that's spread within the profession, the more fluent we become within our own professional language, and the better able we are able to communicate it to others and to the world at large.
And I think that raises a really good point, because often I think nurses, and certainly nurses in practice, but I think also in education, will equate diagnosis with documentation as opposed to with communication. And to me, that there's a huge difference. I mean, we have to document. Every physician has to document and hates it. But right. The diagnoses that physicians use communicate a broad amount of information very quickly, and it's a communication strategy. And right. And I think for nursing, it needs to be the same. Yes, we have to document it. Nobody's going to ever like that. But it's more about how we communicate those broad ideas and concepts and terms quickly and effectively. And I was really struck by what you said about the hunger classification, because we've been working with a group that's led by Dr. Rafael Pessoa from Brazil, who's looking at climate change. And the information that they're identifying related to, you know, particulate matter and how it affects the cardiovascular system and, you know, the breathing issues and all these different responses, we're starting to see obstetrical complications related to even particulate matter from fires. It requires such a specificity of language that we maybe aren't there yet. We don't yet have. So it's interesting that you said that about hunger, because I can see where there's some overlap there with the climate change issues as well.
Right.
You've always been, at least as long as I've known you, and I've known you a while, you've always been talking or have always talked about informatics and the electronic health record and the importance of getting data in the record. Probably long before many of us were even understanding why that was so relevant. And so I'm wondering how you see today the future of nursing terminology within electronic health records in terms of how we can use these terms to improve quality and advance nursing research?
Well, give me a nursing diagnosis off the top of your head.
Ineffective breathing pattern.
Okay. So I would start with going in and finding out how many times the term ineffective breathing pattern is used, plus any number of keywords that convey the same notion without using the same words. Mm. Okay. Because if we're going to develop algorithms, let's say for an effective breathing pattern, we have to be sophisticated enough to be able to use all the keywords that mean or relate to the same thing. One of the fascinating issues today in social media is if you use a word that particular social media platform does not like, it may kick you off or kick off that particular message. And all the user needs to do is to go back and use another keyword, another word in place of the word used initially. And presto, you're back on. That's because the people developing the algorithms within these platforms don't have enough life experience to know all the keywords associated with what's triggering the algorithm. So it's very easy to get around. But in a more complex system where you have a number of individuals accessing the computer, you need to develop that flexibility. Okay, then once you have the frequency of that diagnosis developed, then you have to go back in and see what are the interventions that nurses are using for that particular diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And then you can evaluate outcomes, actual, not whether or not ineffective breathing is relieved 1, 2, or 3 points, but actual outcomes, like in terms of O2 saturation or respiratory rate or any number of other physical as well as Likert type of outcomes. And then with regard to climate change, you might want to look at the etiology of ineffective breathing in this particular patient. Is the patient exposed to triggers like allergens or particulate matter or actual smoke that are interfering with the patient's breathing? Or is the patient giving evidence of a sign of an infection? Or what are the various etiologies associated with, you know, 1 million cases of ineffective breathing? And what are the most frequent? And then write up the results. That itself is a research entity. You don't need to conduct a randomized control trial in order to conduct research. You can employ retrospective studies, analyses of actual data, and that is not the same type of research as a randomized controlled trial, but it is research.
Absolutely. And we're seeing a huge increase, I think, in interest within nursing, certainly within healthcare in general, but I've seen a lot within nursing recently in terms of the possibilities that informatics bring to the table, what we can do with artificial intelligence and big data to improve nursing's visibility in terms of patient outcomes. So I think that's what you're speaking to there. I'd be interested in hearing what you're watching in the informatics world and where you think this field could move us within nursing in the next few years, especially in regards to you know, kind of helping or supporting or improving clinical reasoning at the bedside?
Well, I think AI has the potential for being a great resource in terms of improving clinical reasoning. I think that the best way to engage AI at the present time is conversationally, as far as students are concerned, is conversationally. But the students should, and faculty, need to be aware that AI is, when I'm speaking about nursing diagnoses, is usually wrong the first one or two times around. And you need to engage AI and say to AI, regardless of whose AI it is, actually, that's not correct. That the more correct information on this particular subject is X, Y, and Z. And then AI will usually come back and say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't look deep enough into the issue. You are correct. There is an organization called NANDA. They do look at nursing diagnoses. And here's what NANDA says about X, Y, and Z. So that once you get them on the same page that they are, you know, we're speaking NANDA now, you can now say, well, now develop a design for me in which you would determine what are the best treatments for diagnosis X, and see what it says. And if you don't like it, tell AI you don't like it. But eventually, you know, within a matter of minutes, you can come up with a fairly good design, as long as you don't take everything AI says, you know, at face value.
It's gospel. Yeah. I was just recently at the Ascendio conference in Rotterdam, and it was just fascinating to me to see all of the different applications being used by people in the Netherlands and Italy and, you know, in America, Brazil, all over the place, looking at how to harness what's available within AI to improve a lot of things, whether it's just documentation in general, but specifically how to be able to pull data out of systems to get us to a better understanding of what's going on with patients and how we're affecting them. But sometimes I hear people say, well, once we have AI, once we have, you know, an AI in our computer systems, we're really not going to need these classifications anymore. We're not going to need ICD. We're not going to need blah, blah, blah. People are just going to be able to talk and the computer will figure it out.
And well, the computer uses those systems.
So explain that a little bit, because I don't think people necessarily understand that.
Okay. The AI is only as like any computer system, garbage in, garbage out. If you don't put a classification in, then AI will have no knowledge that there is such a thing as a classification, nor will AI on its own automatically come up with 350 pages of nursing diagnoses. It just won't. It doesn't replace us. It reflects the best of our thinking. And its problem-solving abilities are really quite impressive. But it, in order to solve a problem, it needs information. And unless that information is entered into, unless that information is available on the web, then it has nothing to draw from.
Yeah. When you said garbage in, garbage out, I mean, that's been a statement that we've heard for, I think, as long as we've had computers. But it does make me think about the difference between terminology and classification and the use of terms that don't necessarily have standardized definitions and certainly that don't have assessment criteria that can be validated, those signs and symptoms. And so I'm wondering how you see or if you see a difference between those diagnostic terms that do require assessment criteria and those that don't in terms of advancing research on quality and patient outcomes?
Well, I think inclusivity is a good example. I don't know what Copilot is saying today about inclusivity, But most of the literature refers to it as welcoming or belonging or both. And yet, the experience of people, which is not just classification, but the experience of people, reveals that to be considered inclusive is not just that you belong to a group on paper, but and not just that the people give you some sort of artificially superficial welcome to the group, but that they actually listen to you. They give you credit for what you say. They don't steal your ideas and then present them as their own. They don't ignore you when your hand is up. They don't, you know, they recognize you as a valuable member of the group.
So these are the defining characteristics.
Right. Okay. So, so what do we do with that, though? We need for any kind of defining characteristic or a group of them, we need to reflect upon them. What does that mean for the diagnosis then of inclusivity? It should therefore be broadened, and it should be broadened in such a way that it reflects the experiences of many people. Okay, and that it is bidirectional. It's not just this group welcoming another, but it's the other who's now part of the group giving input and making suggestions, etc. And how do we measure that? Well, we don't have a metric for inclusivity yet. But maybe that might be the next step, you know, so how do we measure it? Maybe we use this expanded definition, and it's a checklist sort of thing. Maybe 10 out of 12 of the characteristics means that the group is inclusive, but we don't know. At that point, we need to conduct research. But that whatever metric we come up with needs to be applicable to any number of different groups. Or there need to be different metrics that are group specific, that are group specific. Inclusivity is not just a amorphous value, it's a behavior. And the problem in the literature is that they speak of it as just a value.
And so those characteristics that you're mentioning that eventually would be metrics that could be measurable are things that would allow then for us to validate when somebody did use that term, that right. They are using the correct term.
Right. And then we also need to rule out what is not inclusivity. We have quite a few examples of that more recently within the United States. That's an interesting phenomenon in itself, in that, what is it, a photo represents 1,000 words or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A picture, a piece of art is sometimes communicates more dramatically what something is not than 1,000 words could.
Mm-hmm. That's very true.
And I don't know how we deal with that aspect of terminology. But once we have a diagnosis, once we have the behaviors associated with it and a metric, then we have a diagnosis ready for insertion into a classification book if it can be validated. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be validated more than one culture.
Absolutely. And in more than one population.
Right.
Hopefully, yeah. And I think that that's the huge difference between terms and a classification is you actually can validate. You can,
right.
you can get to that. You know, I'm curious, Marianne, because you're a nurse practitioner, and I often hear my NP friends or my advanced nursing practice colleagues saying that, you know, nursing diagnoses are not relevant for their practice because their practice is about medical diagnoses. And personally, I find that fascinating because from my perspective, NPs are not there to replace physicians. They're bringing an advanced nursing background and phenomena of concern into every patient encounter. And it seems to me to be a wonderful opportunity to use a combination of medical and nursing diagnoses. And in fact, when you talk to patients about why they like their nurse practitioners so much, it's often right. those, you know, as you were calling them, amorphous things. It's not that, oh, she was able to give me the pill that I needed. It was, she always figures out things I didn't realize were wrong, or she gets me to tell her things that I always forget to say. And I think it's that ability of the nurse to form a relationship with a patient, but also to engage the patient in understanding what's going on, how they're responding to their disease, not just the management of the disease. So maybe reflect a little bit on the differences between nursing diagnosis, medical diagnosis, and how, as an advanced practice nurse, we can use nursing diagnoses in clinical practice in a way that represents the knowledge of our discipline.
Okay, so this relates to hunger. And it starts with a patient that I had in a housing authority apartment building for the elderly and disabled. And he was elderly, and he had cancer of the spine, and he was going to one of the academic health sciences centers in the city, and they were prescribing narcotics. But they were also giving him radiation, which obliterated his spinal pain. But he didn't tell the prescribing physician that he no longer had pain. And the prescribing physician continued to give him narcotics. Now, he made less than the poverty standard, income was less than the poverty standard for the United States. So at the end of the month, under normal conditions, he could either, you know, buy medicines or buy food, but he couldn't buy both. And usually it was food that he let go. So given that he no longer had pain and he was now getting narcotics, and the specific narcotic that he was getting at that time, 2 decades ago, was $5 a pill, he would go back to his apartment building for the aged and disabled. And of course, the aged have lots of aches and pains. And he would sell his strip for $5 a pill. And then he came down to me one day and wanted me to call the doctor and tell him he was out of medicine. And I said, but you just got the script 2 days ago. And he said, but he's out. And I said, but, you know, rumor has it that you're dealing to the elderly, to your, you know, to the people in the apartment building. And he said, what, you don't have to say what people are saying. And I said, well, I do have to tell the truth to the physician. I said, you can stand here, but I'm going to tell the truth. And he said, well, you would have a better chance than I, so go ahead. So I call up the physician and I say, Mr. So-and-so is standing here and he says he needs another script for X. And the physician said, but I just gave him a script. I said, yes, 2 days ago. And he says, well, how many does he have left? And I said, it's empty. And he says, it's empty. Is it okay? Is he okay? And I said, he's fine. And he said, how can he be fine? And I said, because maybe he's not the recipient. And the physician goes, oh. And then he says, send Mr. So-and-so over. So that ended some of the, you know, excess, the selling on the side. Mm-hmm. A few months later, the pain was really back, and Mr. X was dying. And Mr. X comes down one day, and I'm assuming that the audience doesn't really need to hear what the diagnoses were, you know, that the man was selling narcotics, but the etiology was poverty. He needed money to buy food. Okay, so fast forward. And we did connect him with resources that would give him extra food. So then fast forward a few months, and he's dying now, and he really does need narcotics. And he comes in one day, and he's sitting at the desk, and he's not saying anything. And I didn't say anything. I was waiting for him to say something, and he didn't. And then I finally said, "It's rough, isn't it?" And he said, "Yeah, it's really rough." Okay, so I guess, you know, it's rough, isn't it, is sort of a nursing diagnosis. It's acknowledging that he's dying, that he has pain, that the emotions that surround a person at such a time are probably difficult to cope with. And he said, "Yeah, it's really rough." And I said, "Are you talking to God?" And there was silence. And then he said, "Yeah, I talk to him every day." And then I was silent. And then he said, "And you know what?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "He talks to me too." And he died a few days later. Now, I don't know what the exact terminology is, but nurse educators can get upset with me. But he was in need of support, you know, and I think he got that support just by the very fact that I acknowledged that he was in connection with God, and he acknowledged to me in terms of the bidirectionality of nursing diagnoses, we learn from patients, patients learn from us, that he was in close communion with God, and he was okay to die, and he died within a few days, and that was good. That there wasn't any point in getting mad at him about selling drugs to little old ladies who had some extra pain. You know, there wasn't any need to get, you know, self-righteous or judgmental. You know, it could all be taken care of without that, mm-hmm. as long as you diagnose the situation properly.
Yeah. And I think that's a great example, because yes, he had cancer. Yes, he had, you know, spinal issues, et cetera, but he also had these human issues that were going on that somebody needs to deal with. Right. And so as an NP, you can manage both.
Right. Yeah. And I didn't mention his, except for cancer of the spine, I didn't mention a medical diagnosis and I didn't prescribe anything for him. It was all nursing. And was it advanced practice nursing? I think so. I can't imagine myself dealing with it in the same way when I was an RN. Mm-hmm.
So I could talk to you all night, but let me just ask you one last question here, which is, you know, if you had a chance to address a class of graduating nurses and talk to them about the importance of language, its impact on the future of their profession, and why they should be thoughtful maybe about using terms that have definition and have indicators that are measurable, what would you say to them?
I would say that you're not professional unless you do. To me, that's the definition of being a professional, is that when the Nurse Practice Act says that nurses assess, diagnose, you know, treat, evaluate, etc., that term diagnose means that there are defining characteristics that are measurable, that have metrics associated with them and need to be addressed, and have interventions that are diagnostic specific with outcomes in mind that you have when you make the diagnoses. These are the outcomes that you're headed for, and you will be measuring those outcomes in order to see if your treatments are effective for that diagnosis. That to me is the definition that's written into every practice act in the United States practically, and is the hallmark of a professional. So for some educators or some nurses to say that there's no place for diagnoses in the field, that's, to me, that's the epitome of being unprofessional, that they have never really grappled with what it means to be a professional.
Marianne, thank you so much for your thoughts. And of course, thank you so much for your vision in beginning the work to standardize the judgments that nurses make and to give voice to those things that are integral to our discipline, integral to our profession, to the way that we think. I want you to know that I think it's so important, and there's so many people around the world who think that this is the way to begin to give voice to the impact that nurses have on patient outcomes. And so thank you so much for your visionary ability there. And to our listeners, I want to thank you for joining the conversation with Dr. Marianne Lavin today. I hope you've enjoyed that conversation. And I would encourage you to join us at our international conference, which will be coming up in Lisbon this coming June. And I encourage you to go take a look at our website at www.nanda.org for all the information. While you're there, don't forget to sign up for our newsletter. Follow us at LinkedIn or Instagram, on Facebook, and you will find links to get your own copy of the NANDA I Nursing Diagnosis Definition and Classification text on our website. Marianne, I would like to thank you for your time here again today. Always a pleasure to speak with you. And I look forward to the next time we can meet face-to-face. And I would encourage guests also to reach out to me, give us ideas about who else you'd like to hear on this podcast, give us a review on the platform you're using for the podcast, and we'd be really interested in topics you'd like to hear about. So drop me a line at ceo@nanda.org. And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the NandaCast. We hope you will join us at our next episode. And in the meantime, let's keep on defining nursing one concept at a time.
Thank you very much. And if I could say just one more word.
Of course.
If you look at the menu above me that's in framed, that was obtained. That menu was obtained in Madrid. And it's the restaurant that Hemingway frequented when he was in Madrid. So it is from a NANDA conference.
I remember that conference. It was a great conference.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. Take care now.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the NandaCast. If you've enjoyed what you've heard here, or you want to challenge our thinking, then let's continue the conversation. Join us and become an active member of NANDA International. Until next time, keep shaping the future of care and defining nursing knowledge, one diagnosis at a time.